And welcome to the Council Connection. I am your host, Fabian Vicks. Before we get started, we have two special guests with me to talk about the state of education. We have Dr. Adrian Robinson and Monique Young with us. And we're going to go going to get this thing started in just a minute. Just part of the show, I do my intro and we say, let's go.
Styles on them like it's common sense. Hopped out the Benz like it's common sense. Put a monkey on my feet like it's common sense. Got gorillas in the streets like it's common sense. Stack the money heads up like it's second nature. Gotta stay pulled up like it's second nature. Keep a chip in my hair like it's second nature. Big wonder make me stare like second nature.
And we got, like I said before, this is the Council Connection. I have Dr. Robertson and Monique Young. If you would, please, doesn't matter who want to go first, just introduce yourself, where you're at, what you do, so forth and so forth.
Okay,
I'll let you go first.
All right, so my name is Monique Young. I run a coaching business called the School Counselor Coach, where I help coach other school counselors in developing a comprehensive school counseling program that goes beyond guidance counseling. And I'm also in my seventh year of school counseling, so I'm working at a school as well as coaching. So it's going to be a fun year.
I am Adrian Robertson. That doctor is new. I just defended my dissertation a couple weeks ago, so it's kind of getting used to that doctor piece, because about 3 years ago, I was actually on here with Fabian when I was kind of starting my PhD program, so it's kind of come full circle now. But I just finished my doctorate at Georgia State University with the amazing Dr. Aaron Mason as my advisor. And I have been a school counselor in Illinois and Georgia, working at the high school and middle school. And then I also have my own private practice called ACR Counseling and Consulting that I have had for about 10 months now. And then I am going to be a professor at Rowan University. So lots of things that have been going on, but I'm really grateful to be here and really grateful to be talking to you all.
Okay, this part of the technology piece that's so much fun, where you know technology just go crazy. Okay, y'all can hear me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're echoing a little bit.
Okay, I had to fix something on the back end on the streaming part. That's why I was trying to add it again into my phone and strain that out. But it's all good now. This is gonna be a tough. It's not really a tough topic what we're gonna be talking about today, but it's gonna open up some conversation. Mm-hmm. Far as with COVID, 3 years, we're never officially out of the pandemic. I haven't heard anybody say, hey, we're out of the pandemic. I haven't nobody has heard that say that officially, but I know it has had an effect on everything we've done as school counselors. And this is the first question. I'm gonna start with Dr. Robertson and then Monique. How has COVID affected your practice or comprehensive school counseling program over the last 3 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of my answers are going to really come from the counselor educator standpoint. I did work a year during COVID in a middle school, and it was very, very interesting dynamic. But it's really affected my work as a counselor educator with my internship students, my school counseling internship students, and the amount of work that they're doing and the amount of crisis counseling that they are doing. We often talk all the time how our kids are in a mental health crisis and how they are doing more suicide assessments, more referrals. They have more students that are having behavior issues. And so it's really affected, I think, counselors in training in the sense of they're learning, you know, all of those school counseling tests, but really they're getting a lot of the social emotional piece in their practice. So I know that's been a lot of what has been talked about in my classes with my students.
I definitely agree with that, with, you know, the whole piece of having to cover a little bit more about depression, suicide ideation, even anxiety now. I will say in my particular practice, when COVID hit, I was at my then elementary school, and that's where I'd done most of my work. So for me, that change had turned from doing a lot of character development. So, you know, the going into classrooms and talking about getting along with each other, or, you know, just like a lot of character words and a lot of character development. But then I started to transition more into like talking about trauma, the effects on its brain, on our brains. And also, I started to see kind of a stretch, or having to stretch myself in my capacity as a school counselor, to really think about the mental wellness of the staff members in the building, because we just know that there was a lot going on for everybody, not just for students. And so there were more conversations between school leadership of like, how can we support, you know, our staff? Like, what are the things that we can do? We've always talked about students, but now we need to bring in, you know, staff and our teachers into the fold.
Monique, I really like, Monique, I think you really bring up another critical point, because when I worked in a school, that was actually one of the things that myself and my two co-counselors, shout out to Ryan and Tamara, my two co-counselors at the middle school I was at, because we actually were charged with doing some social emotional professional development with our staff, mm-hmm. and talking about staff self-care and staff taking care of themselves, but also the impacts of trauma, what it looks like. And interestingly enough, and I'm curious about other school counselors' experiences, was that year, it was that 2020 to 2021 where they were starting to sort of come back in some school districts. And a lot of my counseling was with parents. With parents, particularly mothers, but also some fathers, where they were feeling like they weren't doing good enough, and really providing some social emotional support to parents, because, you know, having to work, you know, having their kids see them struggle when they don't typically struggle, and parents feeling like they're failing when it's really not their fault. And so I think you bring up a really good point. It's the kids, it's the staff, it's the parents, it's everyone that I think is a huge part of what school counselors have had to adjust to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's a great segue to the next question, as far as what are some major changes? What's a major change from pre-COVID to now that you've experienced? You start, Monique, with this one, and put our heads up.
So one of the major changes, I think, just as a school-wide system now, is now that I'm seeing more like funds for mental health and more staff being put into the fold. So that's created a lot of like interesting conversations now about like, how do I collaborate with these new staff members? Like, what do these new staff members do? You know, I've seen Dean of Students pop up a lot more. I've seen restorative justice coordinators pop up a little bit more. And so for some schools, especially like rural and smaller schools, where it was just maybe the school counselor and maybe a social worker, like I said, now there's that conversation of, okay, how do we work together, and how do we not step on each other's toes, and what do we do with these funds now? Because a lot of times we know that the principal is the one who is creating decisions for what to do with these funds. And so, you know, I always say to my clients that you have to really push into those conversations with admin, because if you don't say anything and those funds are for mental health, like, you should have a voice and some type of say or some type of influence on what happens with those funds, because you may have some needs that just haven't been met and you just been, you know, trugging along or whatever. But, you know, that's your time to speak up and say, hey, this is what we need as far as, you know, mental health needs in the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think definitely some principals and districts embraced that and really brought in more mental health folks. I think other ones, like the one I worked in, there was a lot more, there were unfortunately, there was a lot of focus at the school on the academic piece. So even mm-hmm. though they met the requirement, they actually had a position that could have been used for the counselor. It was used for a teacher. And, you know, the kids really needed and the staff really needed that extra person. So that was kind of disappointing. But interestingly, when I think about change from pre-COVID to now, part of the work that I did with my dissertation was looking at COVID and the impacts of things on marginalized students. And when I think about pre-COVID, I think about the struggles and the things that students went through. Post-COVID, I think about the social political climate and how much that is impacting our work as school counselors and the limitations. It's really hard to not address that and think about that, especially in our mental health crisis, because those social political issues that are impacting our students are also impacting their mental health. And so I think it has just become very difficult for folks to do some of the work that they want to do as school counselors or that they used to do as school counselors, because there are so many bans and so many rules and things that, you know, can make practitioners fearful of potentially losing their job because they can't say or do different things. So I think that's another, when I read that question, that is what I think of.
Yeah, that makes me think of now there's a little bit more focus now on the school counseling programs, whereas sometimes I think in certain schools, you know, the counselor's there and nobody's really paying attention. They're just like, go ahead. You know, we trust you. We know you know what you're doing. But now they're just like, oh, now we have these district and these school strategic goals and priorities that are around mental health. And we want to make sure that we can answer to these questions of how are we supporting students' mental health now. So I've seen more counselors saying that they've been asked for like their schedule or like their lesson plans or like what they're planning to do for throughout the school year versus, you know, in the past, it was just kind of like, you know, do what you feel like needs to be done. It's a little bit more of a microscope on us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree.
Some things I've seen since in between that is the rise of defense referrals for one thing. Especially during COVID, because a lot of folks don't realize a lot of these kids were struggling with abuse, ideation before COVID. And COVID was just a microphone to blast out, I need help. And I'm at home by myself, teaching myself pretty much, because parents had to go to work or they had a specific part of their house was for their job. The kid is in their room. They had lost all type of social interaction, which makes TikTok and Snapchat or Reddit, Discord, I go on more the kid's friend, and you see those social emotional skills that are lacking because they didn't interact with their peers for at minimum 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And think about those students that were already struggling as a baseline reader. If I'm a seventh grader, my Lexile should be at close to 1,000 maybe. Those kids probably at 600, going to seventh grade, going to eighth grade. When they tried to do pirate, come back in the building, they was at maybe 550 went down because they weren't reading, which means they're going to might act out more or they'll struggle. But then at the same time, we can't retain these kids because we got to push ball. We're going to have large classes. Like, instead of having 388 seventh graders, you might have 430. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough staffing, which is another part of retraining with COVID now because of staffing. And say, I don't want to be there because I want to be safe. But yet at the same time, I'm not being compensated for what I do. That's a whole nother discussion with teacher pay. And that's a whole other topic. I'll probably touch on that at the beginning of the year. but one thing that both of you ladies have brought up was the SEL part of it. For me, what is your best practice in SEL to counsel students during and post-COVID? For my district, we use Second Step. I'm not going to give my opinion on Second Step here, but look at my face. Something else could be done, but that's neither here nor there. We'll start with Dr. Robertson and then Monique. What are your best practices with students or patients or clients during and right now post-COVID?
Well, I think interestingly, before I started my program, my PhD program the year before COVID, I was just grateful that the school that I, my last school in Illinois, stopped using the G word and actually started recognizing school counselors as being able to do social emotional work. When I started there, they still used the G word. The school counselors did not do that work or weren't seen as to do that work. And so for me, it was really just changing that narrative and really engaging and talking about how school counselors can do that work. And they are trained. They take classes just like clinical mental health counselors. Yes, unfortunately, they don't have the supervision, which I know a lot of folks are talking about in the school counseling field, myself included. But, you know, so it was being in a district that wasn't necessarily proactive. It was a lot of getting them up to par in the sense of understanding even our role. I think post-COVID and working, because I also work with adolescents, a lot of my work is around anxiety and talking about how the climate and how things in life, different systems are impacting them. And how, you know, kid graduated high school and, you know, was used to doing online, but then went to college and it was a different experience. And so how are they managing being in that system and experiencing the microaggressions that they're experiencing? We're talking with my colleagues and teacher friends and how they are managing. And then again, going back to my students, a lot of them have programs like a Second Step. They've done different programs that they have been implementing, and it gives them structure, and I think which is good for them as interns. And yes, I have my thoughts on certain programs and how they work. I know they were big on evidence-based, but also who are they actually evidence-based for? So I guess, you know, I don't know how much that really answered the question because I feel like I will go on and on. But yeah, so that was kind of my experience pre and post about the students that I work with and my clients that I work with.
I would say for me, I'm thinking a little more system-wide again. Just during COVID, I want to say that ironically, this is when me and my team, and when I say my team, our social worker, our behavior interventionist, our admin, we together had formed the school mental health team. And so we had really got good at identifying students and what their needs were. It had kind of been a couple of years that we were kind of building up to, you know, utilizing data, but then also just being consistent with communicating about who we were servicing and how we were servicing students. So that consultation piece, but post COVID or, you know, kind of now, I definitely want to say I saw the effects, the positive effects of us utilizing that time during COVID, because at the time, you know, when March 2020 hit, we were out of school. And when we came back, we were still virtual. That next school year, our district had decided to be hybrid. And so instead of saying like, oh, well, we're just going to, you know, kick back our feet because we don't have kids in the, you know, classrooms and this, that, and the third. Like, we really took that time to say, you know what? We really want to get deeper into our trauma policies. We want to get more into restorative practices. And we utilized that time to train our staff on those things as well, because we were like, we're going to be back in the building at some point. So let's use this time that's flexible to, you know, to read and to study and to, you know, do a lot of professional development on these topics. So when they did come back, they were ready. They were like, okay, we talked about this. And it was more so kind of like a refresher on certain things, but we were just stronger at being able to identify the students, whether they were at home or whether we had them in the school building. That wasn't really a factor for us in still supporting our students.
I'm thinking of Bavar's SEL for us. I know that the pandemic with the grants, with ERP grants, we were able to fund some mental health and wellness facilitators. And it seemed like it's a great position for me if you have a good person that's a good one that's going to really build relationships with students and know about more about trauma care and anxiety and calming rooms and so forth and so on. To me, those are needed for to take a little bit off our plate a little bit. Of course, we're going to be the cat, not the catch-all, but the more so of the go-to person as far as DFAS reports and that type of stuff. And I think some districts possibly might need to look at in-house mental health, not a social worker, because that's a whole nother gamut of family welfare or absentee checks and that type of stuff. That's the one thing I think out of COVID, that's a great thing they did for our district's mental health and wellness facilitators. They're assets to me. I think some places start looking at that. Some start looking at restorative practices. It does work if it's done properly and we get complete buy-in for teachers.
Yeah.
The word is properly buy-in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you bring up something else too that has been, I think that balance of having a school-based mental health counselor and a school counselor and also making sure that administration understands each role, because I think the other issue is that when we get someone who is a mental health counselor, it makes admin think that, oh, well, then I can put all this administrative stuff on the school counselor. And so I think sometimes there's this kind of tension there between mental health counselors and school counselors as far as like territory and whatnot. But I really truly do think they can work together. And I do think that a mental health counselor in a school is beneficial as long as there's an understanding of those roles and how they can collaborate. Because I think mm-hmm. that's another piece. It's so much about this is my role, this is your role, but how are we actually working together for the students?
Yeah.
And how we work together with students brings me to one of our most, it's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? This is a topic that's close to near and dear to my heart. Non-counseling duties. Miss Young, you are a counseling coach. You probably have 11,000 questions about why I got to do 504. Why am I doing IEPs? It's my first year. How am I test coordinator?
Yeah.
Can you walk us through your experience in assisting those your clients or co-counselors on advocating for your experience? Let's start with your experience with non-counseling duties, and we'll go to Dr. Roberts and her experience when she worked in the school.
So I will say that I was really lucky at my first school that I was at, and it's where I spent the majority of my counseling experience. But, when I first came in, the counselor that I had before me, she was a little bit more close to retirement. And so everybody's idea of what a school counselor was going to be was based off of that. And so if anything with non-counseling duties, it would be more so around like when admin would ask me to go tell a teacher to do something, or can you go into such and such as classroom and look at this, or what have it be. So it was almost like treating me like another, you know, assistant principal or something like that. And I had to say to them, like, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And it also doesn't really speak to the responsibilities and duties of my job. And so, you know, I had to remind them a couple of times. And, you know, my principal even jokes now, like, he was like, you was always saying, that's not my job. And I was like, look, I gotta say it plain and simple, because I'm like, I understand that you just don't know. Like, I know that you're not trying to like purposely, you know, be against me or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. but I just have to say it so that, you know, but I will in that same breath, let an administrator know what I can do that falls mm-hmm. into my role. I can't do that, or that doesn't really fall into my job, but I can do this, that, and the third. So, mm-hmm. you know, after that first year, I really didn't have any challenges with non-counseling duties until it came to an administrator change. And then that was when the conversation came up of, yeah, so you're going to do lunch duty? And I said, no, I'm not. I said, you can find somebody else. I said, I don't know who y'all need to hire, but it's not going to be me because I'm not paid to be a lunch duty aide. So I said, I'll be doing lunch groups during that time, but I will not be doing lunch duty. And so, you know, that created a little bit of tension between me and my administrator. But that was just kind of like the precipice of like so many other things that was my notice of it's time to leave this building. So
I got a question from a friend of mine. I'm keeping nameless, right? Keep them nameless. How do you handle, you say, I'm not going to do it, but yet you do it, but you try to get out of it, but you can't get out of it. What would you tell a client how to handle that?
I definitely tell people that you have to weigh out what are all of the things they're asking you to do. And like, you know, how many non-counseling things is it? What are you willing to do? And what are you not willing to do? Like, what is your just absolute fine line? And like I said, now in that same experience, I said that I wasn't going to do lunch duty at that other school, right? I'm starting at a new school and we're in our summer session and what they're having me do, a 2-hour lunch duty. But I was like, you know what? It's only 4 weeks. We don't do it during the regular school year. I'm willing to do it just to be a team player. And I know that it's not going to be a long-term thing. Now, if they popped up in August and was like, hey, that lunch duty, I'd be like, excuse me, time for me to go. Like, that's just my heart. Because I just know that I would be more beneficial using my time in different, you know, places and avenues. So, you know, you have to know for yourself, what is your hard line of what you're going to do? And is there some type of compromise that's possible between what they're asking you to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it also can vary too, right? I hear a lot of elementary and sometimes middle where they get that bus duty, lunch duty. High school, I don't hear it as much. But, you know, we do a lot of scheduling, the college and career stuff. So I think there are non-counseling duties across the board. It just maybe depends on what they look like. But also, I will say, similarly, I think it is important to advocate for yourself and really talk about where your time could best be used. And this goes back to, again, I think everything kind of revolves around systems. I'm a systems person, is that principals don't learn about us and we don't learn about them. Mm-hmm. So when I started having certain conversations, I remember when I worked with my last principals at the high school in Illinois, I asked them what they learned about us in their programs and they all said nothing. Right. And so surprisingly, I didn't get a lot of pushback because they liked the change that the department was going in. We had a lot of turnover and we were doing a lot more social emotional. We were getting in the classrooms more. So I didn't get a lot of pushback from my principals. And I think it also depends on the relationship, because there were times that I told my principal, no, I'm not doing this. But we had that relationship to where I could say it and he wouldn't give me too much pushback because he knew I was saying it for a reason. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you also make the most out of it. The other thing is, it was only if they were extremely desperate, they would ask us to sub. But pretty much every teacher knew that if I subbed their class, the students probably weren't doing what they were supposed to do, depending, because if it wasn't a solid sub plan, then we were doing something social emotional, or I was talking to them about college, or I was finding ways to build relationships. So, you know, I kind of made it my own, and there wasn't no disrespect to my teachers. If they had a solid plan, I definitely followed it. But sometimes it might've been, you know, something that I really couldn't implement. So, you know, we would find ways to do other things, or I would build relationships. If I had to go down to the lunchroom, I never really did lunch duty, but I would go down there sometimes and like joke with the kids or play around with the kids. So while those duties I think are unnecessary, I have told my students, try to make them something that's an opportunity for you to build relationships with students. Mm-hmm. My students used to play Uno. And I tell them, like, I'm coming down there to kick y'all butt at Uno. You know, like, it would be those types of things that you could engage in with the student. So I do think it is important to advocate for those, you know, to not have to do those non-counseling duties. And, you know, if there are some things that you are stuck with, use it as a way to build relationships with students. It's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah.
I know my previous district, I know I have morning duty, afternoon duty, 504.
Mm-hmm.
Morning, afternoon duty, I looked at it. I use afternoon duty as a fair share. The morning duty, I use as non-counsel, but I think I counted that as fair share.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did was I talked to students, made handshakes with them, talked with them, talked with the cafeteria, mm-hmm. because they had grab-and-go breakfast. I used that mm-hmm. time to talk with the kids. I'll be standing by my office door because I leave my door open and have some music playing through the hallway when the kids come in. Mr. B, you listening? Like, yeah, you think I'm just an old person? No, I like the same music like y'all do. Just because I'm counseling don't mean I like trap, don't like trap music. Anyway. But at the same time, though, I'm my third year, I believe, there. We had a principal change. And I talked to my principal. She said, why don't you meet with the superintendent about it? Now, just mind, keep in mind, I'm still doing morning duty. I'm still doing afternoon duty. I'm still doing 504s. And I'm still doing, now I'm assistant test coordinator. Keep in mind now, I got these duties. She said, talk to the superintendent. So I met with Dr. Jones and had a meeting with him in the afternoon, and I showed him the data from the whole district as far as non-counseling tasks, non-counseling duty. The main question he asked me was, who is going to do this? Where can I know your roles. I support you, but who is going to do these duties? I said, assistant principals. That's why they're in that role. They make that money to take that responsibility because guess what? They want to be a principal. So guess what they need to know how to do? All this stuff I'm doing, and I should know how to do this stuff. So, I mean, yeah. I look at it master scheduling too. My registrar went off about three months, and I had to pick up scheduling and registrar too. So, I still know how to do all of those roles to this day, and it might benefit me somewhere. It hasn't yet, but it's going to benefit somewhere.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think the same thing. I became really good friends with our school psych. So she really helped me with the 504 piece and understanding the difference between, you know, with accommodations and understanding what an accommodation is, because we don't get that training. Right. And it's one of those tough spaces. Cause I've had this argument with folks of like, we should get more training, but since it's not supposed to be our duty, they don't want us to have training, but a lot of us do it. So I feel like we should still have some sort of training. So it's a very like fine line, you know, of how we want the counselors to best do their jobs and still best support these students through their 504s. Yes, they're not supposed to be doing it, but if they have to do it, we at least want them to be able to do it well. And I think that's one of those weird spaces, because you're right, who's going to do it? And, you know, if schools actually invest, if we actually invested the money in the schools like we did prisons, and we would have people to do it. But, you know, that's another whole other story, too.
Yeah, 504 people. A lot of folks don't realize when I read some of the 504, like, these accommodations teachers can put in place at any time they want to, like preferential seating, bathroom breaks. Why do I need to put that on paper? Because now if I don't do that, the teacher's liable, which means somebody's certification can come up. I can say, this child don't need this accommodation. They just need to just let me know. You want to sit in the front. This is your seat. You don't move. If you move out the seat, you tell your mom, I didn't sit in my seat today. No, you the reason why you didn't sit in your seat. Or bathroom break, or I just need to stand up for a second. Those are easy accommodations that can be placed inside of the classroom without even putting them on paper. Now, we talk about extended time and that type of stuff, then we get into a whole another level. But 504s really are just making sure that the kid gets extra bathroom break or to get the stand up but they want to sit there.
No, you're absolutely right. I will say, I don't know about you all's experience. I have had teachers though that were a pain in my butt where I had to put those things in there or else they wouldn't accommodate the kid, you know, and then be mad when the kid gets upset or something happens. So you're right. You are absolutely right. And I've had that conversation too. Some of these things should be best practices for all kids. It shouldn't just be for kids with 504s. But some teachers, because of however they think about teaching, you have to put those things in because some of them won't do it. So it's a,
they feel like that's extra work. They're just like, why do I need to do this? And for this student and only this student, and I got to remember to do this and this, that, and the third. But it's just like, well, I mean, also if you know your students, then you know what specific needs they have too. So, I mean, those, it's one of those tricky situations where it's just kind of like, at what point is this a school counseling role? What part is this an admin and a teacher conversation or instructional coach and teacher conversation? Because like I said, it's like, okay, whenever people don't know what to do, my former director of counseling, he used to say that school counselors were treated like the junk drawer at home. Mm-hmm. Like whenever people don't know what to do with something, they just like, give it to the school counselor. They know what to do. You know, they got some responsibility, give it to them. So, you know, for my former district, we were the 504 coordinators, and it was definitely something that you could tell was expected, because that was one of the first and primary trainings that we got was 504 training. And I remember being in my first, like literally our first meeting as a school counselor, my first year as a counselor, and was like, what? I said, 504? I said, what is this? And like, what do I need to do? Because I, you know, we had only had the jargon maybe during my graduate class, like as a little, this is what a 504 is, but heard nothing of it after that. So when, like I said, we sit in that first meeting, they talking about, yeah, your caseload for 504s. I said, what is that? And am I going to go to jail? Yeah.
So that's the one thing about my new district. We don't do 504s. We don't do MTSS. But I know this year, I can say this. It's a safe space. There are times I came home and just had me two shots of liquor before I even sat down. Lunch duty, transition duty, not just during connections, but literally every transition for my grade level. Afternoon duty. Oh, Mr. V, why are you not in the hallway in the morning? Because on the paper it says I don't have morning duty. So what I do, I'll walk around the whole building and speak to every teacher, every staff member, and walk right back to the counseling office. Like, y'all not going to trap me right here. Nothing to get me like that. No, home team, no home schedule. But I got one last question before I let you ladies go. For those counselors, we got new counselors, of course, we got a new crop of counselors getting jobs, or folks that are transitioning from the classroom to counseling. How can they advocate for non-counseling duties to be removed from their plates, or our plates, or your plate? Dr. Robinson, start with you, then Ms. Monique, and I'm going to close it out.
I was actually going to ask if Monique could go first, because she does the coaching on the comprehensive school counseling. And I can imagine that you do a lot of that work, because I know that's a part of the process of a comprehensive program.
Definitely. And I feel like, especially for like new counselors, this is such a touchy thing. I don't know about y'all, but I feel like a lot of educators are non-confrontational. Like, we don't want to get into confrontation. We don't want to rock the boat, because then, is there going to be a grudge against me? Or, you know, am I going to lose my job? What's going to happen, especially if I'm having these conversations with school leadership or my principals and things of that nature. So in order to like advocate, I really say that, and I've done a live on this before, but really start building a case and being strategic. Like, figure out, this is a good time for you to figure out what are your school, as well as your specific principals, like, goals for this school year. Like, what are the things that are important to them? Because then you can start to add in, okay, well, I don't want to be spending my time doing this. I could be more efficient in these ways, and building it into whatever your school specific goals are, or the strategic priorities of the district. Because sometimes even the principals may not even know what are the, you know, goals for the district, and being able to say like, hey, like, I know that we need to get, let's say, morning meetings off and going. We want to make sure that we're supporting students in this type of way. If I, you know, have, you know, the hour that I'm spending in lunch duty, and I'm able to actually use that time for planning for morning meeting lessons or whatever it is, or consultation, like being specific about how can I spend that time and how does it relate to the goals that we have as a school or a district. Most of the time they're going to be like, oh, you know what? Yeah, because sometimes principals don't want to admit that they don't know the answer to something. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you got to capitalize on that. You are the mental health professional in that building. You might have some other people that are, you know, mental health professionals in the building too, but capitalize on that and just make sure that you are helping them take something off of their plate, right? You help me, I help you. We have goals that we're all trying to do and we're trying to support students. Here's how I can help in that specific capacity. So that's my thing, is build a case around it and really study your administrator and what your district is trying to move forward and do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think I have seen districts where the student services coordinator, administrator of the district, has done presentations to the principals to talk more about the school counselor's role. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things you can do in coming up with that plan is a needs assessment for the school, you know, just something basic to find out what kids feel like they're lacking or what they need or what they would like to experience. And then, you know, if the students say, I really want to talk more about bullying or I want to join a group, you know, then this would be saying like, these students are asking for this need. I can provide this need, but I can't give it to them unless you take X, Y, and Z off my plate. Mm-hmm. So I think that's definitely another plan. Another piece too, because I agree. I'm definitely confrontational.
Most leaders are.
my old principal. I'm definitely confrontational, but I think it's also seeking supervision as a new counselor. Seeking supervision, whether it's going back to an old professor or asking your district leader or, you know, using something like Twitter. You know, I use Twitter all the time. I just did a dissertation about SE chat and using that to ask for feedback from folks, to reach out to other people to see what they've done, I think is also a great way to learn from others who've already done it, would be a great way to advocate. Another piece I think we can do as a counseling field in counselor education is really start to figure out how we can collaborate with our principal programs to see how we can learn more about each other and how we can teach them more about us and they can teach us more about their roles. Because I also think that a lot of us don't understand like what principals do versus an assistant principal, right? Yeah. So if we start at the, you know, where the system starts, where we're training and learning, then hopefully it will seep into the schools. But it's really hard to go back and start teaching principals who've been in the system for years to be like, okay, now you need to change how you think. Because a lot of them are stuck in their ways, right? And so we need to have those conversations and really start in the training phase with both of us to be able to change that and talk about those non-counseling duties and what that may look like.
Yeah. Now, for me, I would say we're a data-driven position now. I would track your data for what you've done for that year. If you're new, of course, if you're new counselor, we have no data, so needs assessment will be your data, and possibly get any data from the counselors from last year and share that out. Second thing would be, if you have time during pre-planning, do something with the staff. So this is my role as a counselor. I'm more than 504s and DFAS awards. Well, my building, I'm more than scheduling and DFAS awards. Mm-hmm. Even though we have a home, we have a house, social worker, I'm more than just, hey, need to do a DFAT report. Oh, we got to get scheduled done. Oh, Mr. B, you lunch manager. I do more than, I'm capable of doing more than that, but this is what you have set because you're, I'm going to get staff to call meetings, but this is a safe space. You have so many new staff members who lack management of their students that you rely on us to be that fifth administrator. Mm-hmm. Yes, I have my certification in administration. That don't mean I'm getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. I should be doing it.
Yeah. It's about relationships at the end of the day for all of us. You know, our relationships with the kids, our relationships with our teachers, the principals' relationships with their staff. If we all work on those relationships and really get to know each other and build that rapport, it makes these conversations easier. And I think because of COVID and just what everybody's going through, a lot more tensions occurred. And so maybe communication was became worse than what it probably already was, right, in schools. But it's one of those things where, you know, again, we just take it back to the basics of building a relationship, having conversations, advocating for ourselves, and also thinking about the work that we do and how it's beneficial for students and all students. You know, one of the, something that comes up now is anti-racism, which I'm wearing an anti-racist shirt right now, is, you know, when we're advocating for these, to get rid of these non-counseling duties, to do other things, are we actually addressing all students? Are we actually looking at what is beneficial to everyone? And right. Or are we continuing to perpetuate the systemic barriers that impact our kids? So again, there's just so many things I think that we could talk about when it comes to this. I could talk all day.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying it affects our jobs every single day. So yeah, this is a very important topic.
And mental health, that's a whole nother topic. Again, that's been one of my topics. 504. That'll be my topic next season. 504. Why? 504. Monique and Dr. Robertson, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your summer break, living your best lives and hopping on this little old podcast. I really do appreciate y'all coming on.
Thank you for the input.
Absolutely. Anytime you want us to come back, let me know, especially when it comes to mental health, because that's like your jam.
But yeah, we definitely gonna do something on mental health. I'll talk about it when we end the show. We're gonna take a 30-second break when we get the housekeeping. We'll be right back. Of course, this is the part of the show where we do a housekeeping course. You can follow us on Fade the PSC and on Twitter, and you can follow us on Council Connection with Fabi Vicks on Facebook. Of course, you can follow my podcast on a variety of platforms. I can never get this right. Of course, you can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Radio Public, Spotify, and wherever your podcast can be found. Also thinking about going to a live stream of this podcast and still strip the audio down for the audio version of it. We're looking forward to start possibly doing that in the fall. I would love to do it in the fall and see how the reception go, either live streaming or just posting the episodes and then just, you know, special occasion do a live stream of the podcast and discuss various topics, especially like when it comes to comic book movies with Steve and Caroline or mental health and start of school year. I would love to do something on the start of school year. That'd be great, but we'll see how that goes. Of course, we'll be at ASCA this year on the Sunday, the 16th. I will be presenting with Tara Washington and Kimberly Brown on transition activities on the 16th at 3:30 p.m. They put it late, which means once I finish my presentation, I will have to get ready for the gala at 6:30. So that leaves me a little time to get ready for that. But it's going to be exciting. I can't wait for that. It's going to be exciting. If you're an administrator, you listen to this episode, or you're a counselor or educator, you like to come on the show and just discuss different topics, you're more than welcome to. You can hit us up on Twitter at Faye the PSC or Council Connection with Fabian Vicks. And we'll make that work. We're right back with my final thoughts. Fabe's final thought. I am torn between what my parting shot is going to be on this episode.
is between the ruling from Supreme Court or the incident in Chicago where a woman was being beaten by a man at a restaurant and her son came in and shot him to death. Right now, I'm going to hold off on the Supreme Court recent ruling because I need to do a little bit more research before I talk about it. I want to make sure I get my facts straight. I'm not misinformed on this. But the incident in Chicago is more of a disturbing issue that happened within the last few weeks. 14-year-old child was arrested for murder as well as the mother for a man being shot in a restaurant in West Pullman, which is a suburb of Chicago. It's a polarizing topic. If you don't know what happened, basically a woman's in a restaurant ordering food. She was saying it's wrong. Man was upset that she was holding up the line. He started hitting on her. The son came in there, shot the man. The man's name is Jeremy Brown, 32 years old. This is a tough incident to talk about because this is things we've seen before, possibly. And this is something we most recently talked about. We just talked about on this podcast with things that we might have as triggers or things we've seen as with our kids. You don't want nobody to lose their life. Let me start off with that. At the same time, this man was beating on this woman for her telling the folks at the restaurant her order is not correct. The child saw the man beating his mother and shot him. Basically self-defense, because we don't know what was going to happen next. Of course, now reports come out that the woman is also suing Chicago for a civil suit against Chicago for her and her son being arrested. Basically, when you look at it, self-defense. I do a separate podcast, sports podcast, where one of my colleagues was saying the man lost his life and he didn't have to die. Did the woman have to be beaten? Is her life not valuable? Full transparency. I talked about this on an episode about my mom when she died. We were living in California. And I remember this incident because we moved back to Virginia in 1990. That would be going to my 8th grade year. So I was in 7th grade when I was in California when this happened. I was getting ready for school. My mom and dad were having an argument, I believe. They had to, because there would have been no reason for this incident to happen, that my dad struck my mom in the face. He hit her. How do I know he hit her? Because I was coming down the stairs and I saw him slap her. I saw him hit her in the face. Could have been a slap, could have been closed fist, I don't know. But she was hit in the face and she fell down. Don't know how many times he did it. But I do know, if I was in that position to see somebody hitting my mother, and I had a gun, we do not know what would have happened to me 31 years ago in California. I do know if I did see my dad hit my mom and I had access to a gun, who knows what would have happened. Two people would have been walking out of there. So with this young man, of course he's 14 because he's a minor. He's, of course, his name not being released because he's a minor. The woman's name is Carlisha Hood. She's 35. She has a concealed carry license on that. One of the charges also, I'm a little bit all over, but I'm just trying to make sure I have the correct information. She also was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Keep in mind now, the child saw her mom, saw his mom being beaten by another man, struck in the head repeatedly. He was protecting his mom. I don't understand where all the fallout is from. Well, he didn't deserve to die. Well, she didn't deserve to get beat. She didn't deserve anything. She was getting her order. What we do know now, that the charges have been dropped. She is sued in Cook County, of course. Yes, a man lost his life. Doing something he shouldn't have been doing, beating on a woman. Doesn't matter, stranger, family, friend, wife, whatever. It's the one thing I've had firsthand experience and which have drove my ethos to this present day is that you do not put your hands on a woman. No matter how angry you get, you walk away. You leave. You cool down. Let it go. It's not worth it. No matter what is going on, you do not strike another person, especially a woman. To an extent even where she cuts you out like a dog and she puts her hands on you, you walk away. Because anything can happen if you put your hands on a woman to a point where you can hurt her, she can hurt you, even to the extreme of a slight push might turn into her or yourself being dead by various means. Like I said a few moments ago, I have firsthand experience of the situation, seeing a man hit a woman. We need to also look at, not just from the perspective of was he wrong for shooting the man, or why did she have a gun? She has a right to carry a gun because she has a license to carry and a concealed carry license. The question we need to be asking now is, this young man killed somebody. How is he going to be doing going forward for the rest of his life? How is the mom going to be doing after seeing her son shoot somebody to defend her? Those are the questions we need to be asking. Have they been suggested therapy going forward from today? We need to put our arms around this family and they need to get the help they need versus trying to lock them up for defending themselves against somebody. If you felt comfortable beating a woman that you do not know and straight beating her down, to me that lends me a signal of he's been beating on people the majority of his life. If we had to interview any of his family members or his loved ones or wife or fiance or girlfriend or whatever, and they were candid, he has it's a possibility he has violent tendencies. We don't know. I'm just going by what I've seen. For a man to beat a woman with no remorse like that, we don't know. But I do know that this family does need to reach out and get some grief counseling, some therapy. Because this is going to be a long-lasting issue, especially for a teenager, 14, going through puberty, where we know teenagers, their emotions are all over the place, and they just constantly changing and growing and whatever. We need to make sure going forward that they're okay. My last point, I want to say Chicago, Cook County DA, you did the right thing by dropping the charges. The mom suing the county, that's within her right. I don't know what's going to happen from that, but I do know what's going to happen, needs to happen, is that these two need to get into some type of form of therapy and counseling. Because we don't know what type of long-term ramifications it's going to have on them. My final lesson is, if you're mad, walk away. It's not worth it. Don't hit women. Don't hit men. Men don't hit men. Men don't hit women. Women don't hit women. Women don't hit men. Walk away. But you don't deserve to get beat either, though. That's my show. I want to thank you for listening. Once again, thank Monique and Adrian for popping on my podcast. And I'm out.
Keep a chip in my hair like it's second nature. Big wonder make me sad like second nature.